The following talk by Scott Ritter was sponsored by the Madison Institute and held in Madison, Wisconsin on April 19, 2008. Scott Ritter served as Chief Weapons Inspector for the United Nations in Iraq in the 1990s. Earlier, as a major in the U.S. Marine Corps, he was a ballistics missile expert in military intelligence. Recent books by Ritter include Waging Peace, Target Iran, and Iraq Confidential. The title of Mr. Ritter's talk is Waging Peace, Citizens in a Time of Unjust War. Scott Ritter.
I am not an activist by training. If we were here to talk about the situation in Iraq, I'd be extremely comfortable talking with you. I lived that life. I walked the walk, therefore I feel qualified to talk the talk. You want to talk about war? We can do that one too. Arms control, whether it be in the Soviet Union, Iraq, Iran, North Korea, I'm very comfortable with these issues. But to have me standing before you, especially an audience composed of activists, real activists, people who have cut their teeth on activism, makes me very uncomfortable because I am not an activist, at least not by training. It hasn't been my life calling. I joined the military in 1979, the product of a military family, growing up overseas on military installations. My definition of citizenship was always based upon a very shallow benchmark of military service. I felt that the best way to express myself as a citizen of my country would be to volunteer for service in the armed services. And I did this. And I served, but that was my life. I wasn't an activist. I didn't speak before the media. I didn't address crowds in colleges. I didn't speak before town hall forums. That's not what I did. I spoke before small groups of Marines, motivating them to do really insane things like take that hill. I was pretty good at that. I'd speak before groups of United Nations inspectors, trying to convince them that it really wasn't the definition of insanity to get on an airplane, fly into the middle of Iraq, armed with nothing more than a blue passport that said, I am an inspector, and go nose to nose with Iraqi soldiers carrying loaded AK-47s. I was good at that. I was good at appearing before international leaders. I traveled extensively around the world. I went to the White House and would brief the national security community in the White House Situation Room. I'd go to England and address the British intelligence in a variety of forums. I did the same in France, in Israel, in Russia, in Germany. I was comfortable doing that. That's who I was. That's who I am. But it wasn't until my resignation in 1998 that I was confronted with an additional requirement that was thrust upon me. You see, if you make a decision to resign, as I did, and you cite as the primary reason a matter of principle, you say that I'm not quitting because I'm disgruntled. I'm not quitting because I'm bitter. In fact, the job I had as a United Nations Chief Weapons Inspector was the best job I ever had. It was one of the best paying jobs I ever had. That was an important aspect of it. But more important than the money was the mission. It was a grand mission, a job built around the notion of getting rid of weapons of mass destruction. And that was something that I was completely and utterly dedicated to. So it was not an easy decision to walk away from that job. I only did so when it became apparent that I could no longer continue doing that job and look myself in the mirror and say, you are a credible figure. It would have been a charade. It would have been a fraud, a well-paying fraud that I could have gotten away with for years to come, but a fraud nonetheless. So I resigned. And now I'm into a completely different world. I've likened it to basically stepping off the abyss. And now you're in a free fall. And as you're tumbling down, looking at the onrush of the ground, you say, well, now what do I do besides go thump? What is my purpose? I could walk away from this. That would be the easiest thing to do. simply register the fact that I will not participate in a fraud and walk away and do something else. In fact, probably make a heck of a living, because I could have defined myself as some sort of expert. I hate that term, expert. I think some people heard why I hate that term, expert. I've been called an expert on numerous occasions, and I am sort of embarrassed by the biographical resume that gives someone that qualification. In short, oftentimes you become an expert because you are the first person ever to do something, and you got lucky, and it came out okay. And so now when they say, well, we need someone to do this again, they go, well, Ritter's the expert, but the only qualification I have is having been the only person to ever have done it. That does not make you an expert. But I could have reframed myself as an expert. I could have been employed in any number of think tanks. I could have written any number of polemics on arms control and this and that and the other thing. But I had resigned on a fundamental issue of principle. I had resigned because I was in violent disagreement with the policies of my country. And it wasn't a matter of academic disagreement. It was a matter of moral disagreement. My country was doing the wrong thing morally. We can have policy disagreements. We can all say, I want to go here, I want to do this, I want to do that, and we can debate these things. You know, there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And just because one side wins doesn't mean that the other side now has some sort of moral certainty to oppose them and say they are evil because they prevailed in a debate. No, it doesn't work that way. But my country, the United States of America, was embarked on a path that meaningfully diverted from that which we claim to represent as a nation. We had policies built on a framework of lies. We claimed to be a nation that embraced the rule of law. We claimed to be a nation that, when we undertook to sign up for an international agreement that carried the weight of law, that we would follow that, but we're doing a completely separate track. We would say one thing and do another. And this I could not tolerate. So now the question was, and this is where I had to confront myself, what do you do about it? What do you do about it? My entire career was about saluting smartly and obeying the orders, fighting the system from within, so to speak, but never confronting the system in such a public fashion. And I decided that the best thing I could do as a citizen would be to stand up and confront what I thought was the wrongdoing of my government. So I did so. I became an activist. But I had no training for this. None whatsoever. And this is why I get uncomfortable, because I'm supposed to be here today talking with you about issues of activism, about how do we better organize, about how do we focus our mission. With all due respect, I should be in the audience listening to you. There are people here who have much more experience doing this job than I do. I am not only new at this, I am a dilettante. I have a very shallow understanding. I am not someone who is comfortable bearing the mantle of activism. So why am I here? In short, I think it's because I was dumb enough to take the first step. And the one thing they say about Marines isn't that they're dumb. It's they're stubborn. Marines don't quit. Marines stay focused. Marines want to accomplish the mission. And I think that's what I bring, a sense of mission accomplishment, a sense of a prerequisite that if you're going to engage yourself in a struggle, that you will organize yourself and you will conduct yourself to achieve victory. You will win. And one of the things I have to say about my experience with my newfound friends in the activist community is that while I saw an awful lot of dedication, an awful lot of commitment, sincere belief values, I saw very little organization, and I did not see a laser-like focus to achieve victory. I saw people who were willing to accept the inevitability of defeat. People willing to go through the motions of carrying out a demonstration that had no vision, no strategy of post-demonstration follow-up activity, therefore making the demonstration little more than an exercise in self-gratification. Let us all hold hands, light candles, sing Kumbaya, and we will feel good about ourselves, and we will go home, and nothing will happen. I spoke out, and I started getting phone calls from people saying, Scott, thank you for speaking out. Would you come and talk to our group? Scott, thanks for writing that article. Would you come talk to our group? And I would come talk to the group, and I would talk about my experiences. I would talk about Iraq, because I'm comfortable talking about Iraq. I would talk about arms control. I'm comfortable talking about arms control. I would talk about the duplicity of my government. I'm comfortable talking about that, even though it's an uncomfortable subject. But then at the end of the day, they would all raise their hands and say, Scott, what do we do now? And I'm not comfortable with that. That's not what I was prepared to engage in. I did not want to be a leader of an activist organization. And so I refused to accept that responsibility. I kept stepping back, saying, no, it's your job. You guys figure that one out. I'm here only to talk about weapons of mass destruction. But I found over and over and over again, wherever I went, that people kept saying, okay, thanks for defining the problem, but what's the solution? What's the solution? They confronted me with that, and then it hit me that I was failing as a citizen. Because the one thing the Marine Corps always taught me is that if you're going to raise your hand and say there is a problem, you better come to the table with a solution. That it's the easiest thing in the world to snipe from long distance. It's simple to sit there and say, you guys aren't getting it right. But when they raise their hand and say, okay, smarty pants, you tell us how to get it right. You say, well, that's not my job. I'm just going to go on and continue to criticize from long range. I realized that I was the one that was in the wrong. So in 2006, I decided that I would take a stab at coming up with a solution. I got tired of being asked the question, what do we do? So I sat down and I said, you know, the first problem in solving a problem is defining the problem. And this is around 2005, 2006. And one of the things that I had noticed is that wherever I traveled in the activist communities, there was sort of a feeling of euphoria. People were saying, the tide is turning. They were saying, we're winning. They were saying, if you take a look at the polls, the overwhelming number of Americans are now on our side, identify with our cause. They're against the war in Iraq. And I scratched my head because I saw those numbers. I'd be on radio shows saying, you know, the American public is numb to the reality. The American public isn't engaged. And they said, no, Scott, you've got it wrong. The American public is engaged. The numbers say so. At that time, they were talking about 62%. It went up to 76%. I think the numbers are even greater today. The percentage of Americans who view the war in Iraq as a mistake, that it's wrong, that we shouldn't be there. So I said, okay, let me dig deeper into this one. When we went into Iraq, I think a liberal number of the percentage of Americans who were truly anti-war at that time, against the war in Iraq, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, I'll say 15%. I think that's a little high, but I'm going to go ahead and give the benefit of the doubt. 15% of the American public truly articulated what I would call an anti-war position, either because they don't believe in war, that's a smaller minority, but there are people out there who have a firm personal belief system that says we cannot participate in acts of violence. We're truly anti-war. There were others who said that this war hasn't been justified. I think that's a larger number. People who said that the case hasn't been made. that we haven't been shown that Saddam Hussein has the weapons of mass destruction. People who said even if Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, war is not the answer, that we have to exhaust all venues possible short of war. And others who said, I'm willing to go to war, but we have to follow the rule of law, that we have to get the Security Council of the United Nations in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations to pass a Chapter 7 resolution, thereby legitimizing the use of force. However you want to describe it, 15% of the American public said that we shouldn't be going into Iraq. The rest of the American public was either indifferent or in a post 9/11 frenzy, thumping their chest wildly like this was a sports event, saying, USA, 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 go. Katie Couric, the wonderful, wonderful Katie Couric. Navy SEALs rock. I mean, it was beautiful to hear her say that. I'm sure the Navy SEALs thought they rock as they were being helicoptered in behind enemy lines. That's what was going through their head. We rock. No. But that's the way America approached the war, is sort of a game. And it was a game that went well. I mean, we had all the trappings of entertainment. We had embedded journalists going forward with the troops. We got live video feed, and it was all good stuff. I mean, sometimes we had to put in the grit of war, the sandstorm, the odd tank, the odd soldier dead, but more often than not, it was about the progress of the troops, the brave troops fighting in the field, confronting the enemy, and ultimately, with the collapse of the statue in downtown Baghdad, achieving victory. And the American public went, hoorah, victory. And we sat there in awe as the president strapped on a flight suit and landed on an aircraft carrier behind a banner that said, mission accomplished. And the majority of Americans said, yeah, mission accomplished. We're feeling pretty good. But then the reality started to set in. Maybe this mission wasn't accomplished. Maybe this war hadn't gone the way that we were told. WMDs weren't found. That's sort of curious. The president said there'd be nothing but WMD over there. The troops aren't coming home. The troops are dying. The violence is getting worse. We're not winning. We're not winning. We're not winning. And now I figured out why so many Americans articulated a position that was anti-war in 2005 and 2006. It wasn't because they were anti-war. Heck, if we had gone into Iraq and mission accomplished had been an accurate assessment, if the troops came home, Saddam Hussein had been overthrown, the seeds of democracy planted, and were alive and well and flourishing in Baghdad, the majority of the American people would be saying, this was a great war. Good job, Mr. President, because we won. The anti-war movement didn't have numbers because people had become anti-war. The anti-war movement was looking at numbers of people who had become anti-losing. They were against the war because we weren't winning the war. And this is a very dangerous place to be as a nation. Because I know as somebody who has played organized sports most of my life, maybe not as recently as it should be, but most of my recent past life, when you're not winning, you want to be winning. If we're getting our butts kicked in Iraq, there is a dangerous tendency to try and seek some sort of victory elsewhere. And when we talk about issues like Iran, if the numbers of Americans who are against the war in Iraq are derived not from being anti-war, but anti-losing, it is incorrect to juxtapose those numbers onto Iran and say, because so many Americans are against the war in Iraq, they'd be against the war in Iran. That's not true. Because so many Americans are against losing in Iraq, they might want to seek victory in Iran. This is the kind of analysis that needs to take place and is not taking place or wasn't taking place in the anti-war movement. So I wrote an article and I confronted the anti-war movement. I said, you guys are getting it wrong. America's not anti-war, they're anti-losing. And the biggest losers in this proposition, besides the American people who are losing democracy, is the anti-war movement. You're the personification of losers. You keep saying you're winning, but I'm looking at the scoreboard. It's the fourth quarter, and it's 60-0, and you're not changing your game plan. You keep going in and fumbling, throwing interceptions, but coming back going, we're winning, guys. We're winning. Clock's running out. Not only are you losing, but you lost. And one of the reasons why the anti-war movement lost and is continuing to lose is that, frankly speaking, there is no anti-war movement in America today. There is no anti-war movement. There are groups around the country that call themselves anti-war. I've attended a lot of their meetings. I've walked with them in demonstrations. It's an interesting thing for a conservative Republican, former Marine, to be walking amongst the activists. It's an educational experience. I participated in a couple so-called anti-war demonstrations. I thought I'd be marching with people that had a sign that said, no blood for oil. That's a good slogan. I like that one. Get the troops out now. There's a great slogan. Free Mumia. What? Why is that here? Why are we talking about free Mumia? In corporate domination, no more Starbucks, free the green turtles, save the whale. Is this an anti-war movement protest? Or is this simply another exercise in activism? And that's what I found most of the time, is that rather than being an anti-war movement, we had grassroots organizations that were comprised of activists, people who mean well, but frankly speaking, most of their focus is to be against something, namely against government, against the corporations, against big business, against nuclear energy, against that, against this. And you know what? One of the things that I found in my entire life is when you define yourself as an organization that's anti, that's against something, you don't get too many followers. People want to join an organization that's pro something, for something. And yet when I would sit down with these different groups, and I traveled again from California to New York, from North Dakota to Texas. I can't say I've been to every citizen activist group in the country. I can't even say I've been the most, but I can say that I have a fair sampling of it. And if I asked them to write a mission statement, well, they all might say that we are an anti-war group. If I said, please write your mission statement, I would get a different response from every group. They all stood for something different. It even gets better than this, guys, because one of the jobs of these anti-war groups, these activist groups, you always hear them complain, nobody takes us seriously. The media won't cover us. We'll never have an opportunity to get our message out because we're not given the respect we deserve. I always ran through the hypothetical TV interview. I've done a lot of TV work. I've been on a lot of TV shows. And, you know, they're going to give you your microphone. You're going to get your 3 minutes or your 30 seconds. So we can go through the hypothetical debate between the progressive anti-war activist and your archetypical gun-toting neoconservative evangelical. All right? There you are, the two extremes. I'm the TV host, and I come up and I go, Mr. Right-winger, what do you stand for? Who are you? You say, Scott, me and my organization, we stand for basic American principles. We're about guns, God, and gays. Every American should have a gun. Second Amendment gives us that right. We're God-fearing people. God should be involved in every aspect of our life, especially the sacred bond between man and woman, marriage. That's who we are, and that's what we are. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Right-winger. Mr. Activist over here, left-wing progressive, what do you stand for? Pulls out a 21-page manifesto. We believe in clean air. We believe in an equal working wage for all. We believe that turtles should be treated as life that is sacred. We believe that this, that, and he's about halfway down the page when they go, well, thank you very much. I haven't even started yet. Your time's up. You don't have time to read 21 pages. Mr. Right-winger, wrap it up. Who are you? Guns, gods, and gays. Those are the important core issues. Thank you, sir. Mr. Left-winger, well, I'd like to get back to, thank you very much, sir. Now you're the audience watching this. Which one exudes organization and structure? You may not agree with everything the right-winger said. You may not agree with anything the right-winger said. But you got to sit there and go, they got their act together. And when I'm talking about leading my country in a time of troubles and travails, that's sort of maybe the person I want at the helm as opposed to this person who's fumbling with a 21-page manifesto. And this is the problem. There is no focus. There is no focus in the activist community, especially when it comes to the issue of war and anti-war. Now, it's curious. We talk, people say, well, we got another problem, Scott. How do we deal with the issue of support the troops? It's a big one out there. You see, I want to be against the war. But the second I say that get the troops out, they say that you've betrayed the troops. You're against the troops. And that's a tough one every time we start. So we hesitate to get involved in these activists over here because we don't want to be accused of turning our backs on the troops. That's a fair point. I mean, sort of. I always tell people when they do that, I say, well, let's get you out of this place where you're obviously not comfortable and transport you into a comfort zone. Close your eyes. You can do this with me, work with me. Close your eyes. And it's now 2:30 in the morning. And unless you were me last night doing a radio interview on Pacific Coast time, you're asleep. And you're comfortable, and visions of sugar plums are dancing in your head, and it's wonderful, and all of a sudden there's this dun, dun, dun noise. Dun, 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 dun. Your eyes open up. What is that noise? It's coming from the hallway. So you struggle up, and you come to the hallway, you open the door, and there's smoke in the hallway. And it's hot. You say, oh God, my kids, my house is on fire. You try to make a run through the hallway to get across the end of the house where your kids are asleep, but you can't because the heat knocks you to the ground and you're choking in the smoke. So you make it back to your room, you shut the door. What do? You pick up the phone and pray to God it works. Why? Because you want to dial 911. For what purpose? To call the fire department. Why do you want to call the fire department? Because your house is on fire. It's burning down and your kids are trapped. So you dial 911. Now, when you make that call to 911, what do you want to happen? You'd hope that the phone line would get picked up, not by a computerized voice machine saying, thank you for calling 911. All our operators are tied up right now. Stand by. The average waiting time will be 5.3 seconds. Knowing that fire doubles in size every 30 seconds, you realize you'll be dead. No, you want a voice, a human voice, a live voice, picking it up saying, 911, what's the nature of your emergency? And you say, my house is on fire. They say, that's okay. Get out of the house and the fire department will come. I can't get out. It's burning. Stand by a window. The firefighters will be there shortly. And you're praying they're going to be there shortly. You're praying that when the dispatch and the firefighters are actually in the station, they wake up, they get dressed, and they come up in their rig. And you don't want that rig to be a horse-drawn carriage. You want that rig to be the most modern firefighting vehicle possible. And it's going to rip up, and you want them to hit a hydrant, and you want that hydrant to work. You want water pressure to be there. You want the firefighters to be well-trained, well-equipped, well-led. You want them to come in and save your life and put out the fire. And then they do that. And you love your firefighters at that point in time. You think they're the greatest thing on the face of the earth. Do you love fire? No. You hate fire. You hate fire with all your heart. But you love your firefighters. You love the firefighters. You want to make them the best trained, best equipped, best led organization possible. So in the event that you have to dial 911, they're there to do their job. But you don't worship fire. You condemn fire. We don't give medals to arsonists because we love our firefighters. We don't practice, let's light a fire day. We practice fire prevention. We train our kids to come home and tell us to change the batteries in our smoke alarms twice a year when the clock moves up and when the clock moves back. We talk about building codes that protect us from fire. We're anti-fire as a society. We don't like it, but we love our firefighters. Why can't we use that same approach when we talk about our military? Why can't we say we love our military? We want our military to be the best trained, best led, best equipped force the world has ever seen. Because God forbid we have to dial 911 when a threat manifests itself. We need that military to be there and do the job. And what is the job? The horrific job of fighting war. But do we love war? Absolutely not. We hate war. We condemn war. And as a society, we should become focused on war prevention. Now, if I explained it this way to the average American, they'd say, yeah, I can buy into that. They could understand that by being against war, you're not against the troops. Just as by being against fire, you're not against the firefighters. But now, when you take a look at how you articulate who you are and what you are, do you think there's a difference between saying, I am anti-war, and saying, I am a war preventionist? I think there is a little bit different approach there. Because if you define yourself as anti-war, you allow others to define you as anti-military. Whereas if you say, I am a war preventionist, I want to prevent war, no one can accuse you of being anti-military. Nobody can accuse you of turning your backs on the troops. And it's this kind of, not only, you know, the terminology that we have to reconsider, but we have to reconsider our approach. Because think about it. How have you as an organization handled the issue of betraying the troops? How have you dealt with the issue of selling yourself to the American public? And this is the critical aspect of any organization that claims to be activist. Because what are you an activist for? Again, if you're simply in it to feel good, okay, that's what floats your boat. If you're in it because you're one of these inherently grumpy people that's against everything, that's okay. This is America. Freedom of expression, baby. Go forth and conquer. But if you truly say, I am a citizen, and my activism is focused on achieving real and meaningful change, then you have to ask yourself, change, I mean, what is change we're talking about? Is this a frictionless environment? I mean, are we just moving forward to change? Or do you think Newton's second law of physics might apply here? I think it does. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Do you think as you seek to move forward and achieve change in society that there might be an opposing force? Do you think that people might actually try to create friction to prevent you from accomplishing what you want to accomplish? See, a lot of activists, especially anti-war activists, say that we don't believe in struggle. We have a fundamental problem with struggle. We are Gandhians. We believe in Martin Luther King. We believe in peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience. We don't want to create struggle. That's not what we're about. Well, that's not what Gandhi is about. Gandhi was about peaceful nonviolence, but he was all about struggle. Gandhi wasn't about making things comfortable for the other side. Gandhi understood the basic fundamental reality of activism, that it is a war. Not the kind of war where you fix bayonets and you shove them into the enemy's belly and twist it for effect, but the kind of war where you are engaged in a life or death ideological struggle for the future of your nation. And this is what the anti-war movement needs to sink into its psyche, that you are at war. There are forces in America that don't want you to succeed. There are forces in America that, as we speak, are conspiring to defeat you. They will crush you. If you approach every problem as this fine and dandy kumbaya moment, you will lose, because they're viewing it as a war, a battle, a campaign. And if you don't organize yourself accordingly to fight this kind of campaign, I will guarantee the outcome of everything you do. You will lose. You will lose. And I don't want to be a part of an anti-war movement whose core value is defeat. Because that's basically how you've allowed yourself to be defined, as losers. Now, this is a hard thing for people to swallow. They say, I'm not a loser. My organization isn't a losing organization. Yes, you are. If you're anti-war, we're losing. You need to understand that. We're not winning. The pro-war forces are winning. Any successes we have are derived from serendipity and accident and circumstance, not because of something we've done. You need to understand that every time you stood up in 2005 to move forward to push Congress in the direction of embracing an anti-war policy platform that after they got elected, what did the Democrats do? Did they turn around and say, we will now do everything we promised we would do? Or did they turn their back on the anti-war movement and move forward and do their own thing anyways? Why do you think they did that? Because they got away with it. Because there is no anti-war movement. The anti-war movement has no meaningful constituency. It can organize on a national level and manifest itself in electoral process. The anti-war movement can't elect people to office. Their slogan was hijacked, but there was no organization to back it up. And that's a reality we have to focus on. So here's the question. In America today, understanding how America works, knowing that if we're engaged in ideological warfare, we need to do the calculus of democracy. We need more votes, don't you think? Isn't that how it works? On election day, is it the side that has the best message that wins, or is it the side that has the most votes? I think it's the side that has the most votes. You'd like to believe it's most votes because they have the better message, but it's the most votes. What is the anti-war movement? What is the activist movement in America doing to get the most votes? And again, this is one of those things where you have to look in the mirror. I see a lot of people organizing in a manner that pleases their immediate community. Sort of like preaching to the choir. You know, you got your little choir there and the preacher's preaching away, but unless you're filling the pews with the citizens out on the street, it's a wasted exercise. What are you doing to broaden your base? What are you doing to get your message out to those who aren't in the audience today? What are you doing to try and rally the numbers? And the numbers aren't going to come to you. You're going to have to actually go out and get them. Ideological warfare, ladies and gentlemen, that's what it's about. Now, we have to talk about models of organization. And this is where it gets really difficult. Because the anti-war movement doesn't have too many models of success to rally behind. They say, well, Martin Luther King, Gandhi. Those were extraordinary individuals. And I would say that they created organizations that did extraordinary things. But do you want an organization that's based on the cult of personality? Or do you want an organization that's based upon commonly held fundamental belief systems? See, what happens when a Martin Luther King gets killed? Is the civil rights movement that he built able to move forward as if nothing happened? What happens when a Gandhi gets killed? Is the dream of peaceful coexistence between Pakistan and India going to be achieved? And the answer is no. If you build an organization around the cult of personality, you've got serious problems. You need to build an organization where you can have interchangeable leaders, where you can remove one leader one day, plug in another leader, and the organization's still going to function. This is a difficult thing. You've got to organize. Now, do you organize in a flatline model? I mean, that's sort of what I see a lot in the anti-war or activist community. So bring your community together. Bring in 100 people. Who's in charge? 100 hands go up. We're in charge. We're the people. The will of the people. We all have a vote. You get somebody that comes up and says, all right, I'd like to push forward Resolution 638. It's a consensus-driven thing. And a little group of three people over there say, look, in the town of White River, we're not going to put up with this. And the whole thing freezes. It doesn't go anywhere. A flatline structure. I'm a firefighter in New York. You know what a flatline means to me? Dead body. When I go up and I put the electrodes on somebody and I get a flat line, I go, they're dead. And if I come to an organization and their organizational structure is a flat line, it's a dead organization. It's not going to succeed. What I want to do is bah, hit it and then get that nice little movement, that triangle, a hierarchy that shows a heartbeat. It shows life. That's how you should be organized right there, ladies and gentlemen. Somebody's got to be in charge. Somebody's got to call the shots. And then there's got to be a chain of command. Efficiency of operations. Now people say, well, wait a minute. We don't accept this hierarchical structure. You want to turn us into the military? No, I want to turn you into winners. You think a football team succeeds when they all go out in the field and everybody's calling their own play? All right, guys, we're going to drive to win the Super Bowl. 34 up the middle. No. Throw a long bomb to me on the side. No, 34 up the middle. Well, I'm going to run the long pass. And if you don't throw it to me, it's your fault we didn't win the game. Coach calls in and says, I want to replace somebody. I don't want to come out right now. I'm happy doing what I'm doing. Penalty, 12 men on the field. Does this model of success? Absolutely not. It's not the model of success. Now, why would I ask you to organize? Well, first of all, history shows that well-organized groups have a better chance of victory, and I'm all about winning. But the other thing is, again, we come back to the fundamental principle. Ladies and gentlemen, how many people in the audience would call yourselves an activist? How many people say that, you know, I'm an activist in one way or another, I've done something? You know, it's not an insult, I'm an activist. I do stuff. I go out and I do things, participate. Now, but you know, if you're gonna say I'm doing something, how many of you feel that you're at war right now? All right, that's a good number. Y'all should put your hands up. If you call yourself an activist, you're at war. How many define yourself as a warrior? You've got to get all the hands up, guys, because you're at war. If you're going to call yourself an activist and say you're at war, you have to understand that. Now, some people say, I'm inherently uncomfortable with that. I don't like the idea of being in struggle and war. That's not who I am. I'm a pacifist. Bull. You woke up this morning at war. It's a war we fight every day. It's called the war against gravity. You know, you're struggling against gravity as you get up. Simply coming here today, you carried out a campaign. You may not know it, but if you drove your own car, you had a logistical preparation you had to go through. You had to plan out, do I have gas in my car? If I don't, I need to find the gas station on the way here to get gas in my car. I better put money in my wallet or have a credit card to get the gas. You're already starting to think like a campaigner here. Where am I going to park? Am I going to be able to park close or far away? I have to judge my time accordingly. If I have to park far away, I need to walk in. Do I want to sit in the front or the back? Do I need to get here early or late? A contingency plan. I want to go down University, but what if there's construction? Do I know to turn right on Johnson and head up an alternative route? Do I have a plan A, a plan B, a plan C? We do this all the time. You do it shopping, taking your kids to school. Life. This is how you lead your life. Why wouldn't you do this? And carrying out activism. Why wouldn't you understand that you are in a struggle? People say the anti-war movement doesn't have the resources necessary to take on the forces of the military-industrial complex. Yes, we do. Do you think the Viet Cong had the same military budget that the United States did in Vietnam? Do you think the Viet Cong just gave up and said, hell, we can't spend $1 trillion, quit. They're gonna outspend us. They got more soldiers. They got more of this. No, the Viet Cong said, we will be more efficient with the resources we have. And that's what I ask of you. If you think about conflict, what is conflict? Conflict is friction. That's what it is. Friction is conflict. Now, if you take two opposing forces and they come together in a simple conflict of friction, the side with the most mass is going to win. History teaches us that. Lee versus Grant. The wonderful Confederate General Robert E. Lee with his wonderfully motivated Confederate soldiers took on Ulysses S. Grant with his gigantic Union army, and they fought battle after battle after battle. And Lee was a better general. His soldiers were braver and they did better things. And when 5,000 Confederates died and 10,000 Union died, everybody said the Confederacy's winning. Except the Confederates can only replace them with 2,000 troops. The Union replaced them with 15,000 troops. They meet again in battle, and the friction starts again. And in the end, what happened? The Confederate Army got ground down to nothing, and they lost. And if you want to go up against the military-industrial complex, let's use the accurate term that Dwight D. Eisenhower put out there, the military-industrial congressional complex, and you want to engage in a simple battle of friction, you're going to lose. What you need to do is reduce the amount of friction that you create with your organization and increase the amount of friction that is created for the military-industrial complex. Now, how do we do this? This is why I speak of the art of war for the anti-war movement. I don't want to train you to be generals and colonels. I don't want to train you to kill. I want to train you to win. You need to win, so you need to know how winners win, and the best winners out there are some military figures. Sun Tzu wrote a book, The Art of War. He said, when you actually engage in battle, you've lost. That's pretty anti-war, isn't it? You know, there's a guy named John Boyd. I want everybody to read about John Boyd, U.S. Air Force Colonel, transforming the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps used to be about an organization that said, take the beach. The old joke, how do you want a bar fight with Marines? Find a brick wall, throw some water on it, throw some sand on it, and say, hit the beach. And the Marines will run up and just bang their head against the wall, and they'll all be knocked out, and you won the bar fight. That's how the Marine Corps used to operate. We'd storm the beach. How does the Army keep their boots dry? Let the Marines take the beach. You can walk in on the bodies of the Marines. They'll all be dead. They'll pave the way. That's what we did. But suddenly we realized, you know, that's not the smartest way to fight a battle. Maybe we want to look at maneuver warfare. Instead, if the enemy's got all their forces on the beach, maybe we go around them. Maybe we go over them. Maybe we don't even deal with them. We go over here. Maneuver warfare. The indirect approach. Reduce friction. John Boyd was a master of it. He was a fighter pilot. And what John Boyd did is he studied his airplane. He studied their airplane. He studied weather and pressures. And he realized that in a given battle, knowing what he knows about his capabilities and their capabilities, if he is able to initiate the action, his action will generate a reaction that can be anticipated with an immediate action, reaction, and within 20 seconds, he would shoot down any enemy fighter in the world. He called it the OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, act. Observe, what do you got going? Who am I? Who are you? Orient, where are we? What are we doing? Decide, based upon that, do something. That's the toughest one sometimes. Decide what to do. But even tougher than that is once we made the decision, act. Act immediately. And as soon as you act, observe again. Get reorient, decide and act. The OODA loop, the decision-making cycle. And if your decision-making cycle is quicker than your opponent's, then you are inside their decision-making cycle. And that is a guarantee of victory in combat, because now the enemy is reacting to you. You are determining the field of play. You're making decisions. Your friction is reduced. Their friction is increased. And in this battle of mass now, you suddenly have an equalizer here. You can come in with a smaller force and grind the bigger force down. The OODA loop, the decision-making cycle. But when I tell people in the anti-war movement that it is Colonel John Boyd, United States Air Force, the father of maneuver warfare in the Marine Corps, that came up with this, they say, we don't want to know anything about this. We're not a military organization. No, but if you don't embrace the OODA loop, you're losers. You're losers, because that is a guaranteed formula of success. The OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, act. But now, in addition to this, you've got to have an organization capable of doing that. Because no matter how good John Boyd is, if he comes in the battle flying a Sopwith Camel and the enemy's flying an F-15 Strike Eagle, you're going to lose. The Strike Eagle is going to win. You've got to organize. Organized, but what model do you use? You know, in the fire service out west in California, they got these gigantic wildfires. You might have seen them on TV every now and then. They're pretty big. And they're bigger than one fire department can handle. They're bigger than one fire service can handle. The Forest Service can't handle this. They're bigger than what the Department of the Interior can handle. Fact is, when they have the big fires, they have to bring in all the fire departments in Southern California. Now, what happens when all the fire departments show up? One of the top dogs in the fire service is the chief of the fire department. You get the Madison Fire Department chief, he'll tell you, he's top dog. Who's in charge of the fire department? I'm in charge of the fire department. Who tells the fire department what to do? I tell the fire department what to do. What happens if we get two chiefs together? Who's in charge? I'm in charge. What happens if we get 20 chiefs in charge? Who's in charge? 20 chiefs are in charge. Not only that, what happens if you go to one chief and you say, hey, I need a tanker? I'll get you a tanker. But do I mean a big truck with water? Or do I mean an airplane with water? I may be thinking I want a truck, but they send me an airplane, and it doesn't help me. We're not talking the same language. We're not doing the same thing. I can describe a tactic, but if it's not agreed upon, if we all haven't trained that way, the tactic doesn't happen. And frankly speaking, another fire department isn't going to take an order from me. They're going to keep looking to their chief. How did the fire service overcome this? Something called the Incident Command System, ICS. And basically, the incident command system trains every fire department in the country to understand a core set of principles, organizational structures, and responsibilities. So when you say incident commander, they know who that is and what that is. They know what an operations officer is. They know what a logistics officer is. They have different terminology. So when you show up at a fire scene and you say, we are assigning you to Sector C as Strike Team Alpha, they go, we know exactly what that is. We know what we need to do. And they show up. They've reduced the friction now. They're operating in a coherent fashion, and they defeat the fire, as opposed to 20 fire departments running around doing their own thing. The incident command system. Now, people say, well, that's cool, Scott, but we're the anti-war movement. We can't train like that. We don't have the resources. Yes, you do. Believe it or not. How many people have the internet or can gain access to the internet? I hope everybody raises their hand. Even if you don't have it at home, go to the library. They got it. Type in FEMA. Don't spit when you type it in. Type it in. Go to the FEMA website, and you'll navigate. Type in ICS 100, and you'll be suddenly brought to an online course. The beauty of the incident command system is not only that it will make you more efficient as an organization, the government will train you for free. The government that you're in opposition with on occasion. Take the ICS 100 and the ICS 200 courses. Everybody can take this. And suddenly everybody's working off a commonly held definition of organization. Now you can have 20 different organizations, grassroots organizations that do their own thing. But when they come together in a joint action, you can't have 20 bosses. Somebody's got to be in charge. You implement the incident command system. The 20 people get together and say, Joe Smith, your incident commander. He knows exactly what that means. Joe Smith puts on his incident command hat, and he then builds a staff, and then he starts assigning people to roles, and things happen. Now, does that mean that's permanent, that Joe Smith's always in charge? Absolutely not. But when the incident's done, everybody goes back to being their own thing, just like the fire departments go back and be their own fire departments. They do their own thing. But the next time there's a big fire, the next time there's an incident, and you come together, you morph into a structured command system. This needs to happen. It's there. It's easy. But will it work? When you bring all these people together, do they have a shared belief system? One of the things you need for organizational success isn't just that people show up, but people share the same value system, that people agree on the same mission. What is the mission statement? What is the core value of the anti-war movement? And again, I ask that question, and I can get 21-page manifestos that all say different things. So I've put out something that I think is going to assist the war prevention community in having a better chance of interfacing successfully with mainstream America, thereby building an organization that has the numbers capable of prevailing in the electoral combat that we're waging in our nation today. And that core value is simply this: we're Americans. We're not activists. Don't call yourself activists. You're citizens. You're doing what citizens should do. You're citizens who adhere to a commonly held system of values and beliefs. And you'll say, well, Scott, that's nice, but what system are you talking about? The Constitution of the United States of America. If you call yourself an American citizen, if you say, I am an American, then there is only one thing that defines an American, and that is the Constitution. Everything else is derived from that. This must be the core value system of any citizen activist group. Because the moment you deviate from the Constitution, the moment you say that something else represents a higher power to you, you're no longer an American. You're something different. As I said, be careful of patriotism and hyper-patriotism. Be careful of those who wrap themselves in the symbols of a country, the flag, little lapel pins. I can stick a pin on a monkey and teach them and have him wrap himself in a flag. It don't make him patriotic. I always went up and had discussions. I did a couple of debates with some former secretaries of defense and CIA, and they all had the big American flag on their lapel. And the organizer an academic his entire life. I'm not picking on academics. Turns to me, this was in Texas, and he goes, "Son, why ain't you wearing an American flag?" And I said, "With all due respect, sir, I wore one on my uniform in combat. I know what the American flag is, and I don't need to wear it here tonight to prove anything to you. I won't allow these people to hijack the symbol of my country." But it's just a symbol. The core value is what we have to embrace. The Constitution. Now, I speak at high school after high school, college after college, and I ask every audience, how many people in the audience have read the Constitution? And I ask for a show of hands. Let's do it here today. Honestly, how many have read the Constitution? That's great. That's a good percentage. Keep your hands up. How many right now who have read the Constitution are willing to take a test where mastery of the subject is 80% and you're going to guarantee that you're going to pass the test? It gets reduced considerably. And of those who kept their hands up, some of them aren't going to pass the test. Ladies and gentlemen, how do you defend that which you do not know? How can you say, "I am an American," but you don't have a working understanding of the Constitution, which defines what being an American is? If you're in the anti-war community, you're in the activist community, whatever you want to define it as, you had better take pause to go back and touch base with who you are and what you are. And if you started out with "I am an American," you better learn this Constitution, and you better encourage others to learn the Constitution as well. People keep asking me, "What do we do?" I say, read the Constitution, live the Constitution, breathe the Constitution. And you know what will happen? It will tell you what to do. It'll tell you how to act. Because you'll understand that in this system of governance, that it's not a dictatorship of the executive, but there's another role, an important role, a critical role played by the legislative branch. There is legislative process. There is the rule of law, due process. And you understand that the legislature is a product of the will of the people, and if the legislature is not doing its job, it's up to we, the people, to get a legislature that will do its job. And you're starting to define the field of battle. Then you carry out some military-type principles, intelligence preparation of the battlefield, understand what you're dealing with. You go forth, you get your decision-making points. However, when you organize your campaign, you will know what to do because you now have focus. But if you don't know the Constitution, you will easily lose track. You'll easily go off course. This is the biggest challenge that I can put forward to people, especially those in the anti-war movement, or as I should say, the war prevention movement. Here we are in a time of war. American troops are overseas, engaged in combat. They're in harm's way. They are dying. They are killing. They are being killed. They honor us by wearing our uniform, the uniform of the United States of America. It is not the uniform of the president. It is not the uniform of the Congress. It is the uniform of we, the people of the United States. That is important terminology derived from the preamble of the Constitution, our Constitution. So now we have the soldiers over there, and they're dying. Or sometimes they have a fate worse than death. They don't die. The 19-year-old kid, freshly married to his high school sweetheart, goes over and has his brain addled by an explosive device. He come home in a wheelchair, drooling into a bag, peeing into a bag. His brain's not functioning, but he's not going to die because he's a miracle of modern medicine. And now his 19-year-old wife is stuck with him forever, a fate worse than death, because he will never get better. And the government is not going to give him the support or her the support they need. We say support the troops, but it's a slogan only. We turn our back on these people. We send them off. We subject them to horrific mental harm. Even if they come back physically intact, their brain is permanently damaged by what you see, the horrors of war. What are we doing for these troops? We promise them an education, but we don't deliver on that promise. Support the troops. Just a slogan, ladies and gentlemen. These troops took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, our Constitution. They're there to protect us. Don't we have an inherent obligation, therefore, to ensure that before we ask them to make this sacrifice, it is in a sacrifice worthy of the cause? That should be our mission statement, worthy of the cause being the Constitution, the ideals and values of this country. And if I can imprint anything on an activist group, it's that. You need to establish a core value system derived from the Constitution. And if your organization isn't doing that, it had better start doing that. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
The foregoing program was sponsored by the Madison Institute. Co-sponsors include the UW-Madison Center for World Affairs and the Global Economy, the Middle East Studies Program, and the Global Studies Program. Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of the sponsors.